Evening. My name is Bob Darrell, and I am an alcoholic.
Hey, Bob.
Only through the grace of a God that I was afraid to believe in that I found out through AA is absolutely crazy about me and has no taste. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, as they're outlined in this book, good sponsorship and a consistent commitment to the primary purpose. I haven't had a drink or any mind or emotion altering substance since Halloween 1978. And for that, I owe AA my life and my freedom. I'm delighted to be here. I'd like to start with a little opening prayer that it's an extrapolation of something I got from one of my mentors, Don Pritz. If you'd give me a moment of silence. Lord, help me to set aside everything I think I know about you, everything I think I know about myself, everything I think I know about others, and everything I think I know about my own recovery, all for a new experience in you, Lord, a new experience in myself, a new experience in my fellows, and a much needed new experience in my own recovery. Amen. I am glad to be here. I'm glad to be doing this with my dear friend Scott. Seems like every year we do a little more of these. I think it's a progressive illness. and I do quite a bit of these, and I enjoy doing stuff with him more than anything else. A couple of things. I'm just for our curiosity. How many people are within their first 90 days? Anybody in their first 90 days? Not to embarrass you, just one
back here.
Okay, great. Well, I'm glad you guys are here.
Fantastic.
How many people are in their first year? Okay. Anybody in their last 30 days? No. Okay. Every once in a while, I get a taker.
Yeah.
I can't speak for Scott, even though I think we're so much on the same page about everything, but I don't consider myself an expert on the big book or on any of the three legacies, and we do have three in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they're equally important. And we're going to be covering a lot of one legacy this weekend. And it's like a three-legged stool. It's an important leg, but if it's all you got, it's a hard juggling act to stand on a one-legged stool. And we're going to be covering the recovery deal. And what I am is I'm a guy who in 1971, as a young kid, came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in an institution and tried to stay sober with the fellowship, tried to stay sober with the combinations of the fellowship and medications from a psychiatrist, tried to stay sober with combinations of outpatient, AA, church. I mean, I tried about everything there was to try. And in 1978, I fell into the hands of some people that entered me into some actions in my life that I wouldn't have taken if I'd have been in my right mind. And they took advantage of my weakness in a moment of desperation and got me to do some things I normally would have never done. And I continue to do this to this day. And eventually they helped me to put this process into my life, and I've never been the same since. And those of you who have worked this, done this deal, put this into your life, it's almost like you feel compelled to try to pass it on to anybody who'll take it. You can't help it. It bursts out of you. And it has burst out of me for all these years. And I love talking about this stuff. I'm not a step technician. Matter of fact, I'm a guy who does exactly what Alcoholics Anonymous tells me to do, is that share my actual experience. And what we're going to talk about this weekend, don't mistake it for the answer. The steps and the process is not the power. It's the vehicle to the power. And I think sometimes in AA we're in danger of creating some sort of new 12-step religion where we worship the process and forget what the point is. Mm-hmm. And we engage in this experientially to describe a path that in our experience we've taken this, that has led us to the power. Scott.
Thanks, Bob. I'm Scott Lee. I'm alcoholic. And very grateful to be here and honored to do anything at all that has to do with this fellowship that's touched my life and saved my life and changed my life. I'm deeply grateful and very moved to have the chance to come here and share with you what's been so freely given to me. I also am not an expert on this. I'm a student of it. And I have been blessed to have some pretty fabulous mentors. I would like to open with a couple of things. For those of you who own cell phones, there must be at least one or two. Everybody here would like to look at your cell phone right now. Why don't you get it out and then open up and show it to them that you've either got it turned off or you have it set on stun. Okay, if you could do one of those, I think that would be really nice. And because we have some space cadets here. They should know about that. I'd like to open anything that I do with a quotation from Lois Wilson, co-founder of Al-Anon. Was asked one time what she did in the moment of silence, and she said, we have it a lot of, I don't know how they do it here, a lot of places around the country, they have a moment of silence and then the serenity prayer. Mm-hmm. Someone asked her what she did in the moment of silence, and she said, I invite God to the meeting. And it's not that I don't believe God's here. I believe God's here. But I get a special gift when I stop and honor that presence. And that's what I use that moment of silence to do, is I literally invite him. Don, that he mentioned, was also my great teacher. And Don told me a lot of years ago that he had learned to treat God like a gentleman. It was his experience that gentlemen didn't go where they weren't invited, and they didn't stay where they weren't made welcome. And so it's my job, I believe, each morning. It's one of the first things I do when I wake up, is to invite God in to run my life. Not give me some help, but run it. And then I try to conduct myself during the day in a manner I think will make him welcome. And that really kind of ties it all together. With this many new people, there's a pretty good chance somebody here doesn't have a God, if that's your situation. I'd like to invite you to borrow mine while we're here for this weekend. You can address him as the God of Scott's limited understanding. Get you off right there on the right foot. And by the way, if you brought a big book with you, you might want to bring it. We're going to do a lot out of the book. So if you got one in the car, you might want to bring it. Page 46, there's a paragraph that begins at the bottom of page 46 with the word much, and with any luck at all, I will get back to the prayer thing here in a minute, but I think I'm making kind of an important point. It was for me. Bottom of 46, paragraph begins with the word much. If you count three lines up above that, it says it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power which is God. So this God as you understand him thing doesn't mean I'm going to understand God. Miss Linda says that if God were small enough for me to understand, he wouldn't be big enough to handle some of the things I'm going to need for him to handle. So it's not about me understanding God. It's about I don't have to believe what anybody else ever told me. And that gave me a great freedom. The other thing that I do in the moment of silence is I ask God to help me not judge any of the speakers. You don't have to do that. But I'm going to tell you right now that meetings got better everywhere for me when I started doing that. So if you would, let's take a couple of moments of silence. Let me ask you if you would be willing to just invite your God or borrow mine to join us and bless us with open hearts. And we'll follow that with a serenity prayer. Serenity prayer. God.
Good. Give me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. Courage to change the things I can. And there was another.
I can't pray that fast. I'm from the South. I'm sober since the 28th of June of 1984. And just to kind of qualify a little bit, I'm a member of the Backroom Group in Nashville, Tennessee. We're having AA meetings. We don't do group therapy at all. And our chairperson brings us a topic out of our literature and sets a topic in less than 3 minutes. And we talk about recovery every time. It's really been fun. And I've been to some open discussion meetings, and it's really been a lot more fun the way we're doing that. sorry about that. I'm a little spiritual low tide there. I'm being as good as I can. I think if the big book says anything, it's important. I'm a big book guy. If it says it twice, it's really important. If it says it six or seven times, I think they're really trying to reach me with something that's going to be very important. For those of you who brought your book to class, page 143, And I call this chasing a concept through the book. This is where we're going to find it saying the same thing in different words in a number of places. Page 143, if your man accepts your offer, it should be pointed out that physical treatment is but a small part of the picture. Though you're providing him with the best possible medical attention, he should understand that he must undergo a change of heart. I'm told there are no musts in the program. I'm sure that's right, and this is one of them. Must undergo a change of heart. So this has got to change. And then it says, to get over drinking will require. I wonder if that's important. Require a transformation. That's a total change of thought and attitude. Same concept on page 58 in the most read, least listened to portion of our literature. Don't get ahead of me. Four lines from the bottom of page 58 where it says, some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas. The result was nil until we let go absolutely. Exact same concept. Page 51. I had to look up the word fetter. I didn't know what it meant. And it means to restrict. On a trail ride, the cowboys will fetter the horses. That means they tie short ropes to their legs so they can stand and walk, but they can't run. That's what fetter is. Middle of the page, 51. In the realm of the material, men's minds were fettered by superstition, tradition, and all sorts of fixed ideas. Same concept. Page 42. 8 lines from the bottom. It meant I would have to throw several. One is one, a couple is two, several is more than two. It meant I'd have to throw several lifelong conceptions out of the window. Page 27. This is Carl Jung, arguably the greatest psychologist, psychiatrist of all time, telling Roland Hazard that he's in real trouble. Dead center of the page. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. Page 1. When you get to page 1, turn 2 more pages toward the front of the book. So those who are in third edition, those who are in a fourth, it works every time for both. Bob and I are both carrying fourth editions. Our newcomers have got fourth editions. Many of us got somewhere on the third. And the Roman numerals don't match. And the last time I checked, the newcomers were confused enough. They don't need for the Roman numerals. So that's why we're carrying fourths. Paragraph begins at the top of this page with on the other hand. On the right-hand page, if you count up 3 lines above that, it says this is repeated over and over. And unless this person can experience an entire, by the way, is more than half, an entire psychic change, there's very little hope of his recovery. I don't know how many that was. I know we're a couple of more places, but that's enough. I think we've made the point. And what that says to me in plain old Tennessee English is some of what I know for sure ain't so, that it isn't what I don't know that's the problem. When I got here, the problem was what I knew for sure that was actually incorrect. You know, I was seldom right, but never in doubt. And what I needed to do was to release my grip on what I knew for sure. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas. I think everything I've learned through noon yesterday is now an old idea. So I've got to let go of those things. And here's one of my old ideas. I was sober coming up real close to a year, and I complained to an old-timer. If they promised you something and you're new and it didn't happen, go complain to them. I recommend it very highly. And I complained to this old-timer. I said, you guys told me that by the time I was sober a year, my sleep patterns level out, and they have not. I still don't sleep well. And he said, I just watch you drink 2 big cups of coffee here at an 8 o'clock at night meeting. And I said, caffeine doesn't affect me. And he said, if you're pounding out a quart of scotch a day and 5 or 6 joints, it won't. And I said, oh. And I've been sleeping really good ever since. So I wonder today what things I know for sure are actually incorrect. And I'm on a constant search for people who disagree with me. And not to argue. I don't want to argue with anybody. But if somebody disagrees with me, it's a chance for at least one of us to learn something. So if I say something you disagree with this weekend, please come to me at a break and let's talk about it. That could be very, very helpful to me. I could learn something. So if you would. One of the things that I learned and then had to move to the next level on was surrender. I got here, I surrendered. I surrendered a lot of times. And I think of surrender in the military context of the battle and the noise and the broken glass and the blood and the screaming. And we know who's screaming, whose blood that is, right? And I surrendered a number of times. I haven't surrendered a long time. I woke up this morning. I didn't surrender. I volunteered. They're different. The result is very similar, but they come from a different place. And if I close my mind on surrender like this, you can't build on that. I got to keep it open so I can go to volunteer. And I've had teachers that were two levels above that, and I don't have time to talk about that. But so I've got my mind open on volunteer. I think it goes beyond that, that there's always another level. One of my spiritual teachers said that your spiritual assignment will change. And when it does, you must release your grip on the old one and embrace the new. And you'll come to learn to love it as much or more than you did the old one. And I picked this up in another place. It's like I'm wearing a spiritual garment. And when I awakened spiritually, which is the great promise, I was wearing this garment. It was magnificent. But you know what? Months later, it was soiled and tattered. And I had to shed that and put on a new one that was more magnificent than the first. And after a few months. And I don't believe that there's an end to that process. And that's why I'm a student of this thing, is because I want the next garment. I want to go to the next level. And that's why I'm here. It's because this is a chance for me to do that. I got here suffering from what I call the John Wayne syndrome. Yeah. At age 11, roughly, I got a mental image of what a man was, right? And I pretended to be that for the next 30 years. Here's a nutshell on it. Big boys don't cry. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. When the going gets tough, the tough gets going. Never let them see your weakness. Never ask a stupid question. Get what you want. It'll make you happy. Never surrender. Never give up, no matter what. Sound familiar to anybody? That's the act approximately 99% of the men and about 96% of the women are doing when they get here. Trying to pretend to be something, knowing that I'm not any good. See, the only truth I get here with is that I'm not sufficient. Sometime that predates my memory. I do not have memories earlier than I'm not good enough. I'm one of the defective models, and I'm never going to be good enough, and nothing I can ever do will be sufficient. And I became an actor, a chameleon, as a very small boy, pretending to be the guy that I think you want me to be. And I'm doing it all my life. And when I get to you, that's the only truth I know, is that I'm not good enough. I'm never going to be good enough. And if you can see through this act I'm doing to the real me, you won't want me around, because a bunch of together people like you wouldn't have a defective like me in the room if you could get out of it. See, that's all I know for sure. And see, I was just wrong. All that John Wayne syndrome, it's all exactly wrong. It's all perfectly exactly wrong. How many things I have had, just 180 degrees were just nuts. And my life has been a series of laying down old ideas. That's what Carl Jung told Roland that he was going to have to do. And in the summer of 1984, I zipped through a 28-day treatment program in 6 weeks flat. And some of them are doing the math. And I came back to Nashville, Tennessee, where the only person I knew in the city that I knew was in recovery was one of my customers that I didn't want him to know. You recognize that? That's newcomer thinking, terminal case. Probably going to die from this pretty soon if I don't get some help with it. And I eventually got to the point where I was so crazy. What I looked for, okay, everybody with less than a year, don't try to fill in the blanks here. All right, because you won't get this. The ones under a year may well not get this. Everybody, this is a two-word fill in the blank, all right? I'm an insane newcomer. There's only one characteristic I think I need in a sponsor. I'm looking for a sponsor I can
relate to,
right? Isn't that insane? Isn't that insane? I mean, I couldn't figure out your good. I thought if you missed a day in meetings, you just missed. I didn't know if you could go to two meetings in a day, right? Who can I relate to? I can relate to the squirrel on the next branch that didn't know his fanny from straight up is who I can relate to. Thank God I couldn't find a sponsor I'd relate to. We'd both be dead by now. What I needed was a sponsor I would obey. New concept. I got a 24-year chip in my pocket. I don't need a sponsor I can relate to today. I need a sponsor I will obey. Now, I don't expect him to be perfect. If I thought he was perfect, I wouldn't be calling him on the phone. I'd be praying to him. I expect him to make mistakes, but his batting average with my life is so much better than mine was when I got here. Anyway, so I asked this guy to sponsor me. Finally, because I'm just going nuts. I'm 4 months without a drink. My head's rattled around, brain's rattled around in my head like a BB in a boxcar. Right? My head's on 9 radio stations at the same time. Yeah. And And I finally said, would you sponsor me? And the guy says, well, we'll see. Here's your first assignment. I said, assignment? I thought a sponsor, I was wrong about that too. I thought a sponsor like a big brother, you know, or a new best friend, you know, in the new town. Introduce you around a little bit, show you where the good stuff is, maybe loan you some money, fix your wife, that sort of thing. Wrong about that too. Here's your first assignment. It took me a week. I did it. I said, sponsor me. I said, I'll sponsor you my way. I'm nervous now. I said, what does that mean? And he said, you are too sick to stay sober on the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. You will need the program also. And I didn't have any idea what the man was talking about. And he outlived the doctor's predictions by about a decade. And he gave me what he claimed was the single best-kept secret in the fellowship. The number two best-kept secret is that the four steps in the big book. Very cleverly concealed right between the covers of this particular book. Very well-kept secret. The other best-kept secret was the definition of the program. The way we keep that secret is we read it at almost every meeting. It's on page 59 where it says, here are the steps we took, where it's suggested as a
program of recovery.
No steps, no program. Forgive me for being so direct. I've been to too many funerals. Jerry told me that hanging around in a bunch of AA meetings wouldn't any more get me into recovery than moving into the garage turned me into a 57 Chevy. Said, it ain't going to happen. Not going to happen. And you're going to have to do these 12 steps. And he startled me. And so in an unguarded moment, I was honest. Right? Give me a second. I don't have to do that. And I said, I don't want to do the 12 steps. And he said, that's okay. I said, good. He said, long as you do them. I don't believe we're communicating, Jerry. He said, yeah, we are. That's the definition of willingness. Willingness is when you do what your sponsor says, whether you want to or not. He said, you ever try to get sober on your own? Yes, I did. How many times? Well, I don't know. Well, give me a guess. Well, I don't know. Come on, an estimate of some kind. Well, Jerry, I'm a puker, about 2,000. Right? Any other puke? Anybody puke? Any pukers? Come on, where are you? Come on, come on. We didn't come up here to talk to you. Pukers, that's great. How about nose pukers? Ever out your nose even once? Come on, come on. I know you're here. Right. Your nose pukers will quit forever every time they puke out their nose. Is that right? Darn right it is. You bet. Over 2,000, Jerry. He said, and that was doing what you wanted to do and not doing what you didn't want to do? I said, well, yeah. He said, that didn't work. So it must be to get sober, you're going to have to do some things you'd rather not do and not do some things you kind of like to do. Boy, and every time he took a breath, I said, why? Yeah, that's my Sunday punch, why? When I ask you why, I'm not looking for an answer anyway. I'm looking for a fight. Tell me why. I'll show you where you're confused, right? You've given me something to argue with, and that's what I want when I ask you why. Yeah. And he said, I don't answer why questions for the men I sponsor. And the reason is, why is a management question? Excuse me. Step one, section B, says you are not in management. Consequently, all of the why questions, questions begin with the word why, have the same answer. And the answer is you don't need to know. And I hated that. Hated that. Today, I love it. It's one of my cornerstones. Because I always thought that it was not knowing that made me crazy. Incorrect. It was needing to know that was making me crazy. When I laid down the need to know, I became at peace not knowing. That's about me not being in management on this thing. And anyway, I said, why? He says, I'm going to give you one free one on why. This is the only why question you get lifetime. This is the last one. Why do you have to do the 12 steps? And he said, think of yourself as a garbage can. Okay, Jerry, I got that one. Yeah. He said, what we're going to do with his steps is we're going to dump you out. We're going to scrub the can very clean and stand it back upright. And we're going to fish through your life. Most of it is trash, and we are going to throw it away. But portions are good. We will keep them. For example, do you love your children? Man, I like kids a lot. He's great. We'll keep that. When we get finished with this process, you're going to be a big, empty, clean can with just a little good stuff in the bottom. And the reason is because alcohol is not your problem. What? Alcohol is not your problem. It's your answer. Play with me this time, all right? Get ready. When I started drinking, when that second beer hit bottom the first time, I got taller. Who got taller? Come on, taller, taller. How about better looking? You want to keep them up? Who got better looking? Come on, did your pimples not fall right off? Mine did. Fantastic dancer. Some doubles. I got a bad dancer here. Yeah. Yeah. How about this one? Try this. Expert on many subjects. Oh, yeah. It just all made sense. Now I got it. Yeah. And I could talk to the girls, too. I got lubricated lips. You know, all of a sudden I could. But the big one was that for the first time in my life, something inside me went, whew, and it's just okay to be Scott. See, it never had been before. Never had been. And he was right. And alcohol was never my problem, not for a second. That's why the non-alcoholics can't understand. They look at a guy like me and say, alcohol's his problem. They're wrong. It ain't. Never was. I stand by that right now. Alcohol was my answer. And he said, that's why you can't put it down on your own. You put it down, but you can't leave it down. And the reason is because it's your answer. So when we ask you to lay down that answer, this is the only thing that ever made your life work. This is the lubricant of life. Let's lay that down. That leaves you without an answer. And you're the kind of guy who needs an answer. You've never been an alcoholic. It is that simple. And what you're going to have to lay it down and leave it down is a new answer. And the new answer is going to have to be at least as good as the old answer. And he said, that's what this step process is about. That's exactly what it's about. And he said, our program is a little bit like going to the dentist. We're going to have to drill before we can fill. He said, but like the dentist, we got Novocaine. We call it home group. We call it sponsorship. We call it fellowship. We call it love. It's not that hard. It's not as hard as the way you've been living. Guys like us have done it. It wasn't that hard. Not as hard as it looks. And he said he'd never seen anybody in and out of the program, and I'll be honest with you, I never have either. I've seen a lot of people in and out of this fellowship. I haven't seen anybody in and out of the program. I have not personally seen anybody do the steps, work the steps, take the steps. I really don't care what the action verb is. It's not learn the steps, understand the steps, or interpret the steps. Save me. But actually do the work in here while being coached by a sponsor who's already done this and stay active in the fellowship and drink again. Has anybody seen that? I've asked way over 100,000 AA members that I speak at kind of at a lot of conferences. And I always ask that question. I don't get any hands. Nobody yet has brought me that they've seen that. It doesn't happen. So this is not some get it, some don't. This is some do it, some don't. It's that simple. I've only seen two men that I'm absolutely certain did these 12 steps drink again. I sponsored them both. I know they did the work. One of them married his new higher power, and she was not fond of the amount of time he spent in AA. I wonder how she likes him now. And the other one's a hotel manager. He got a job managing a dude ranch in Arizona, 40 miles from the nearest AA meeting. It was 2 years without contact with us. And he was 2 years before he started drinking again, and he's now sober again over 10. Those are the only two I know that did the work, and they went non-current on step 12. That those of us who do this, he said, this is about digging the poison out of your soul, literally. Because, see this, I'm stuck in here. See this? I used to do that all the time. You know what I mean? Go be somebody else. Do it all the time. Now I'm stuck in here. So the first thing I had to do if I was going to live in here all the time was clean it up. And that's what part of the step work's about. And that's why I needed the fellowship and the sponsorship to hold my hand while I did this thing. And he said, the reason that you have to do this, he said, something heavy one day is just going to slam into your heart. He gave an example. He said, your father's going to die. And on that day, if you don't have that big, empty, clean can, little clean, good stuff in the bottom, but big, empty, clean space, if you don't have that to store that pain in, while we love you back to spiritual health, you'll escape. And the only escapes you know are killing you and devastating everyone around you. And I just ran out of why. And I allowed a man named Jerry Crow to coach me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was rendered unthirsty. That was a piece I could, you know, I used to quit on my own all the time. You know, I can quit forever, which, as you know, is somewhere between 20 minutes and about 8 weeks. Don't talk to the earthlings about forever. You would be frightened about how long they think it is. We know certainly not more than 2 months. But is one day at a time one of the things I say? You guys say one day at a time up here, right, Sal? One day, have they told you the second line on that? What they actually mean is one day at a time in a row. With, like, no breaks ever. That's really what they're talking about. I know it is. They didn't fool me. So my deal is I can quit, but I can't get unthirsty. So if I'm gonna stay here, they got to get me unthirsty. I got to get that one day at a time in a row. I got to get unthirsty. Because when I was out there and I'd quit and mean it, sometimes I'd go a couple of weeks, feel better, work better, having a better time, you know, all of that. but something's always coming or I'm going to get thirsty again. I own my own business. I close a big deal, make a lot of money, get thirsty. Lose a big deal, lose a lot of money, get thirsty. Get a new girlfriend. I'm married, by the way. And I'm not proud of that. That's just the way it is. Get thirsty. Get a new boat, get thirsty. Get a new convertible, get thirsty. Or the big one would hit. Oh, man. The Redskins play the Cowboys on Monday night, man. Yeah, and I get thirsty, right? So if I'm going to do this one day at a time in a row, they got to give me this peace I can never find on my own. They got to get me unthirsty. Page 60. What for me is the most powerful promise in this book, first line 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. You hear it read, A results, not what it says. A is one of several, one of many. The is singular. Promise you one thing, a spiritual awakening. It is my experience that spiritually awakened alcoholics do not drink beverage alcohol, and they don't ever get thirsty. Ever get thirsty. That's what happens. I have been continuously unthirsty since sometime in December of 1984. I got the sponsor sometime in October or November and was somewhere in the step process when I had my last urge. If you're new and you know what I'm talking about with the double white knuckle grip on the wheel to keep the car from pulling into the liquor store to get you a pint, I'm not living that way. Cooked turnips make me almost sick at my stomach. I can't eat them. I don't want to be in the house where they're cooking them. I'm having exactly the same amount of trouble staying away from booze I'm having staying away from cooked turnips. It just ain't part of the package for me anymore. It's gone. I have a new answer, and it is, in fact, better than the old answer. It's the way it had to be. So Jerry explained to me I was going to have to do the steps, and he was very direct. He said, you're going to work the steps the way I lay them out at the pace I set, or I'm going to drop you like a bad habit. I do not work with losers. That's what he said. He meant it, too. And I needed something like that. I'm not used to taking orders. I am very used to giving them. Yeah, you hear some more of my story, you'll understand that. And I think the definition of that is illuminated on page Roman numeral 22. I'm sober now. I read the Roman numerals, XXII. Forward to the third edition. That's either third or fourth edition. It'll be on XXII. If you can find the doctor's opinion, keep turning toward the front. You'll find it. Forward to the third. Paragraph begins halfway down the page. The basic principles of the AA program, it appears, hold good for individuals of many different lifestyles, just as the program has brought recovery to those of many different nationalities. My foreign language skills aren't that good, so I'm going to kind of ad-lib just a little bit, but stay with me because the concept that has come is so important. So it says the 12 steps that summarize the program. So that tells me that the steps I see on the wall are a summary. Don, who we talk about a lot, said if you take the steps off the wall, you get off the wall program. I believe that. And that's why we don't have a one-page big book, is because the rest of that's the directions on how to do those things. That's the cliff notes. That's for the folks trying to slide with a C minus. Anybody ever get an F trying to slide with C minus? I did. I can't afford to get an F in this. I must win now. I got to win this time. I cannot afford the price of not winning this time. And I really don't care what the price is. I will pay it. There's nothing in my life that matters to me that isn't suspended from my... Here's my recovery. Here's what hangs from it. My sanity. I've been to the insane asylum. I've been in the little rubber room in my underwear with no doorknob by my side. I bet I'm the only one in here. I bet you... Yeah, I think some of you probably ought to be there now. And sometimes I think I should. All right? My freedom. I should be serving life in a military prison. I flew for the Air Force for 5 years. I flew a mission classified, top secret, and some stuff. Real drunk. Not this .10 social drinker, DUI drunk. I mean, drunk by our standards, drunk. Not proud of that. Should be serving life. Should have died that night and several others. So my life is suspended from this thing. My relationship with a spectacular woman that you're going to hear tomorrow night. My wife is one of Al-Anon's best speakers. I guarantee you, if you listen to her, you'll make notes. You'll go home and start doing some of the things she talks about. She's got a fabulous story and tells it well. My relationship with her and our children and grandchildren, my job, my house, my car, my peace of mind, there's nothing in my life that matters to me that doesn't hang from my recovery. Because if I lose that, everything that matters in my life hits the floor and shatters. And I'm not trying to sell that to you. I have no idea what your situation is. That's mine tonight with 24 years. That's where I am right now. Everything that matters to me hangs from this. I don't care what the price is, man. I'm paying. And I thought the price was high when I got here. Ah, Price is great fun. Continuing. The 12 steps that summarize the program may be called various things, but they trace exactly the same path to recovery that was blazed by the earliest members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed our path. Our path is the 12 steps, according to the foreword of the third edition. One of my teachers told me one time that there were two fellowships, and I think that's a very important point. I think he was right. The first one, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, is described at the bottom of this page. It says, in spite of the great increase in the size and the span of this fellowship, at its core it remains simple and personal. Each day, somewhere in the world, recovery begins when one alcoholic shares with another alcoholic, sharing experience, strength, and hope. We'll be doing that this weekend. He said there is another fellowship. It has considerably more stringent entrance requirements. It is described on page 164 in the text. Last full paragraph at the bottom. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit. Fellowship of the Spirit has dramatically more serious entrance requirements than just saying, I'm in. You say you're in the fellowship of AA, you are. Fellowship of the Spirit, that looks to me like the steps in narrative form. So the way I get into the fellowship of the Spirit is I actually do the steps. And I needed a sponsor. I've never heard of a great coach in any athletic activity that did not at one time or another play the game. You can't become a good coach just reading it. I needed a player coach. I needed someone who had actually done this, who had had his own spiritual awakening and would understand me. Because I'm a curveball. I've been nowhere near the strike zone for decades. And he would understand that and help me understand how to get from where I was to where he was. I have a single goal for the men that I sponsor. My goal is for them to outgrow me spiritually. I can't think of another worthy goal. And I believe that's the one he had. Bob.
Thanks, Scott. I'm Bob Darrell. I'm an alcoholic. Talking about the 12 steps, we're going to cover a lot of stuff out of the book, but probably, in my view, more importantly, actual experience. Alcoholics Anonymous is transmitted best when you bring personal experience together with what's in the book. And sometimes in helping other alcoholics, I've found that my mistakes and my failures are as valuable, if not more valuable, than the things I've done right. Because people connect to that. They go, oh, I'm that knucklehead too. Right? I came to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1971. I wasn't old enough to take a legal drink yet. And I was in an institution. And I observed some things in AA. And I observed some things from counselors, and I was told some things. And I concluded that I was an alcoholic because of my obsessive drinking. And I've come to understand that that's not true. I drink obsessively because I'm alcoholic. It's the other. And it sounds like the same thing, and it's not. Alcoholism doesn't come in bottles and bags, it comes in people. And one of the things that was hard for me to understand is what I was up against. The most horrific, disgusting, painful years of my life were after, the 7 years after I came to AA for help. I don't think there's anything worse than being in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, needing what the people there had, yet not understanding it or getting that it would help, so I don't do it, and consequently I'm dying in the middle of AA trying everything else there is to try except the program. There's nothing worse than that. And I didn't understand what it was to be powerless over alcohol. I could admit that I was an alcoholic, but truth be told, I don't think I knew what that meant. You know, I knew it had something to do with a drinking problem, and there were some drugs mixed in there, and I knew that I was in trouble sort of as a result of a lot of that stuff, but I didn't get it. And on page XXVIII, in the doctor's opinion, Silkworth starts to describe an aspect of alcoholism that it's funny that you could live with it, and it could be part of you, and you don't get it. But I didn't get it. He says here, we believe and so suggested a few years ago that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics, and he's talking about a type of alcoholic, that the action of alcohol on chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. That the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. Well, the first thing that's prevalent to me is I am a chronic alcoholic. I think there's two different types of alcoholics. There's probably more than that. But if you can look across the board in medicine, there's chronic illnesses and there's acute illnesses. An acute illness is very serious. On page 20 and 21, it talks about two different types of drinkers. One is chronic and one is acute. The acute drinker, it describes him as he drinks habitually. It says he has the habit badly enough to gradually impair him mentally and physically. So here's a guy who's drinking habitually to the point of mental and physical impairment. It goes on to say he may even die a few years before his time. Now here's a guy that most doctors or counselors are going to observe and going to go, you're alcoholic. And maybe he is of sorts. But then it says, but if a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, warning from a doctor, falling in love, the judge says 2 years or quit, that person has within them the ability and the power to stop and be actually all right. And I'm not that guy. The judge says to me, 2 years? Well, 6 months later, I'm drinking again. You know, I'm thinking how I'm going to fake this UA coming up. You know what I mean? I'm that guy. I'm the guy who the doctor says, Bob, you got early signs of pancreatitis. Your liver panel's better. You keep drinking, you're going to die. And I will get a fifth of whiskey on the way home to think about what he said. Right? I'm a chronic alcoholic, and a chronic illness, unlike, say, pneumonia, which is an acute, which can almost kill you, but if they load you up with enough antibiotics, they can knock that pneumonia out once and for all. I'm like a diabetic, people with certain types of heart disease. The stabilization of my condition is but a beginning in a lifetime of treatment. It's but a beginning. I am not the acute alcoholic. I'm the chronic alcoholic. And Silkworth says, if you're a chronic alcoholic, then the action of alcohol on me is a manifestation of an allergy. Well, I know a little bit about allergies. I have a mild allergy to cats. I love cats, but if I get around cats in about 45 minutes in a room with cats, my eyes start to itch and water, and my nose starts to fill up. I can even get a little tight feeling in my chest. So the first time in a treatment center in the early 70s that I hear people talk about this allergic reaction to alcohol, I don't get it. And they said, they tried to tell me that instead of breaking out in a runny nose or hives, I break out in this phenomenon of craving, but I can't see it. I can see that I'm in trouble. I can see that I get drunk a lot. I can see I go too far. But I can't see the phenomenon of craving. And the reason why I can't see it is there's a line later on in the book that says the alcoholic's problem lies mainly in his mind. The problem is that when the craving is initiated in me, it uses my mind and all my ability to justify and rationalize and to tell little stories to myself about what's going on in my head to make the next drink seem like it's my idea. I don't get that I'm being driven by a phenomenon of craving. And the allergic reaction in me works kind of like this. I'm not going to get drunk tonight. But I'm going to have a couple drinks just to kind of go, just to relax a little bit. Well, there's a point somewhere between the beginning of the first drink and the end of the second drink when a feeling comes over me. And it sometimes it's if I'm having a really bad day, it can be a very dramatic feeling. Sometimes it's just a kind of a subtler kind of easier feeling. But the allergic reaction is to that feeling. What happens is in me, as I start to feel that feeling, it lights something up inside of me that just goes, oh, yes. Come on. Come on. And I get a feeling that it's like I'm about to become so wonderful that the world won't be able to stand it. Maybe on the next drink. And so I drink one more. I'm the alcoholic. I was up in Boston on spring break 1 year. Some guy had a bunch of pills. It's funny. I don't even ask him what they are. Just thank you, right? I don't even care. I don't even know what they are. I was back. I was part of the I wasn't part of the just say no generation. It was just say thanks, you know, just, right? And it ended up being animal tranquilizer, right? A bad dose of animal tranquilizer. Well, I'm in the party. And I'm laying on the floor, and I can't get up, and my mind's awake, and I'm laying there trying to talk people into bringing me a drink, right? Right? Because if I start drinking and I'm still conscious, I ain't done drinking. You know what I'm saying? Now, I don't get that's an allergic reaction to alcohol. And Silkworth says that this phenomenon of craving is limited to us, to this class, and never, ever occurs in the average temperate drinker, and it never does. If you've ever watched a non-alcoholic drink, I had an ex-girlfriend about 15 years ago that wasn't an alcoholic, and my sister is not an alcoholic, and I've watched, matter of fact, just a couple weeks ago, I was out with my daughter and my sister, and my sister had a drink, and I like to watch my sister drink. I mean, I'll watch my sister drink like your dog will watch you eat a cheeseburger. You know what I mean? Al-Anon, do you hear me calling? I mean, I watch my sister drink. Like, because I look in her eyes. I want to see the thing happen to her, right? And when my sister drinks, I can see it in her eyes when the feeling starts to hit her. It starts to come over her. Right? And in her normal, healthy, non-alcoholic wiring, when she starts to get that feeling, she goes, whoa. And she shuts her right down. It's inconceivable to Marge to ever get knee-walking crybaby drunk. She won't do it. She won't sign up for that. Because she gets a feeling when she drinks like she's starting to lose control. I get a feeling like I'm getting control. It does something for me that it doesn't do for her. And that's why I'm alcoholic. I react differently to alcohol than other people. And it's a hard thing to see. It's very subtle. I remember one time I had this job, and it was actually before I got sober, probably the last job of any consequence that I had. And, you know, like a lot of us, I have this job for one reason only. I need cash flow to keep the medicine coming. You know what I mean? That's really the bottom line. And I need this job. And I was it was really a bad job. I was a telemarketer. I know. Oh, God. And I couldn't do it sober, but I was really good at it when I was drunk. And so because I was one of their top salesmen, they made allowances and I could go in there and I'd drink on the job. And when I'm drinking, I mean, I can sell some stuff when I'm drinking. And one day the boss comes into me and he says, listen, you're drinking again on the job, which is I'm drinking every day on the job. And he says, I've talked to the owner and you can't do this anymore. That's it. We know you produce a lot, but you can't do it. You come in here one more time after today, because he already knew I was drinking, with alcohol in your breath or you under the influence of alcohol and you're done. Well, the next day, I get up and I'm not doing too well and I need a drink, but I can't drink. So I go in there and I tough it out. By lunchtime, I am just wound up like a 10-day clock because those I can't take the rejection when I'm sober. When I get sober, I'm a little overly sensitive. You know what I mean? And so by noon, I am wound up like my head wants to explode. And I start a conversation with myself. And if an alcoholic who's having a conversation with himself is in a lot of trouble. And the conversation is like, listen, I can't sell like this. It's going to be better if I one or two drinks, that's it. It'll be better for everybody. I'll produce more. It'll be better for the company because I am a team player. It'll be better for the company, better for everybody. So I go down to the corner bar in my lunch hour, and I go in there, and I'm going to order vodka and orange juice because you can't smell vodka. Got myself a pack of Hall's cough drops to make sure. I order a double vodka and orange juice. I drink that, and I'm sitting at the bar, and I'm thinking to myself as the effect starts to hit me, this is the United States of America, for God's sakes. This is the land of the free for guys. Who are they to tell me that I can't drink? Oh, who's the best salesman they got? I am the best salesman they got. I don't get in fights at work. I don't hurt nobody. And I ordered another drink, and I'm drinking a second drink, and I'm thinking, I don't get out of line there. I said to the bartender, I says, do I look like I'm drunk? And I walk back and forth in front of the bar, and he says, no, give me another drink. I never made it back to work that day, right? Because every drink of alcohol I've ever taken makes me feel like I'd like to have another drink of alcohol. And that's the phenomenon of craving, and I didn't know I had it. Silkworth says these allergic types can never safely use alcohol in any form at all. Whatever does something for me will do something to me if you're a chronic alcoholic. So what you got to decide for you, what's your alcohol? I know people that alcohol comes in a lot of forms. Sugar, slot machines. If it does something for you, it'll do something to you. And that's what I can't safely use alcohol in any form. Carl Jung, in a statement to Bill Wilson, in a letter he wrote in the early 60s, he said to Bill that he suspected that the alcoholic's thirst for alcohol wasn't really a thirst for alcohol. It was a low-level thirst of his being for unity, or as expressed in religious or medieval terms, union with God. I thirst for something to light me up and free my spirit. I always have. So this is the disease of alcoholism. It touches on this progressive nature. It says we can't safely use alcohol in any form. And once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, their reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve. And that is so true. I think that a lot of people die of alcoholism because they're so overwhelmed with the symptoms that they never see what's killing them. To be a practicing alcoholic is very similar to a guy who's living in a station wagon, partying 24/7. And every time a problem comes up, a court appearance throws it in the back of the station wagon. Somebody dies in his family and he should go to the funeral. He's partying. He can't. Throws it in the back of the station wagon. Children, wives, husbands, family commitments, jobs. Throws it in the back of the station wagon. IRS throws it in the back of the station wagon. Then when he gets sober, it's like running the station wagon into a brick wall, and in slow motion out of the back comes all this stuff. And if you're new and you're like me, people keep saying your problem is alcohol. And I think, man, I'm up to here with everything else. I got police problems. I got emotional problems. I'm a depressive guy full of anxiety. I got don't know how to fit. Now they call it social anxiety disorder. I got that. Matter of fact, you give me a medical book, I'll have most of what's in there, you know, by the time I'm done reading it, right? I got a lot of problems. And it looks to me like if I solve all these problems, then surely at that point I'll be happy enough and comfortable enough that I'll be able to stay sober. And I'm fighting the wrong dog. And I keep relapsing over and over and over and over again. I don't understand what's happening to me. And the disease keeps progressing, and every time I get sober again, now the problems are a little bit more. In here, more than anything. You know, when you come off that run and you hate yourself, every time I came off a run, I hated myself a little bit more. I had a little bit more remorse, a little bit more disgust. And the progressive nature of this alcoholism, it's a terminal illness, and it eventually kills the alcoholic. But it's a long, long, tedious process. Dying of alcoholism is like being kicked to death by rabbits. It just takes a long time. Matter of fact, way before you're dead, you wished you were. You know what I mean? By the time you're dead, everybody you've ever loved hates you. My mother, when I was a year sober and made my first approach at amends to her, we sat there and she started to tell me something. And as she started to tell me something, she started to weep. And she was, because she was ashamed. She said she used to just wish I would die. My mother loved me. That's what happens in alcoholism. My mother loved me. I heard a story years ago, and it nailed this disease, and it wasn't even about alcoholism. This friend of mine had a friend who was diagnosed as terminally ill with stomach cancer. And when they diagnose you as terminally ill, what the doctor is really saying is nothing we can do. Get your house in order. You're beyond human aid. And my friend and everybody was very sad. And then about 2 months went by, and he heard that there was a doctor that was going to perform surgery. And he got excited. He says, oh, my God, they found a doctor who knows what he's doing, for God's sakes. A doctor that's going to go in there and take this cancer out. And he calls up, and he was excited. And he says, man, they're going to get the cancer. And they said, no, they're not. Well, then why are they doing the surgery? Well, they're going to cut out sections of his stomach and intestines and all his internal organs to make room for the growth of the cancer so his last days on earth aren't excruciatingly painful. And alcoholism is a lot like that. Your job is getting in the way of the progression of the disease. I'm telling you, alcoholism will cut your job out of your life. Your children, no matter how much you love them, are getting in the way of the progression of this disease. I'm telling you, alcoholism will cut them out of your life. Your mate, no matter how much you need them and love them, alcoholism will cut that out of your life. Your morals, your self-respect, your values, alcoholism will cut those things out of your life because it has power, and it perpetuates itself. I think alcoholism has stronger survival instincts than we do. It's an amazing disease. And if you think that's crazy, what happens to new people when they're told to write an inventory? How heavy does that pencil become? I found myself, the only time I've ever hand washed my car by myself since I've been sober was to avoid writing on the inventory. I'd go out and wash my car, and I'd be telling myself, well, I'm washing my car. This is good. Right? Where does that come from? It's almost like it's this power of unto itself. It's crazy. It's crazy. The bottom of the page, Silkworth starts talking about another aspect of this powerlessness. If the phenomenon of craving and the allergic reaction to alcohol was all there was to chronic alcoholism, then treatment centers would turn out winners. Because a treatment center would educate you on the biochemistry of the phenomenon of craving. You would get it. You would see that you can't take the first drink because you're, and because you're not, you're bright and you're not self-destructive, you'd say to yourself, oh my God, I'm never going to take that first one again. I'm a little curious. It's just a show of hands. How many people in this room have sincerely swore to themselves they were never going to get high again and then did after that? Anybody? Right? Because there's more to it than that. The knowledge of the phenomenon of craving and the knowledge that you have this thing, God, if that were only enough. But what is it? What is it about me that drives me back to drinking after I've sworn to myself with everything in me and mean it that I'll never touch it again? After five or six treatment centers, when I got the education, you could turn the volume off on a Father Martin movie and I can do the words. I mean, I've been to so many treatment centers. And even with all of that, well, Silkworth starts to touch on that at the bottom of page XXVIII. And this is really the first time in the book that I started to get a little bit of a glimpse of what was really killing me, of the what I've come to understand is this malady of my spirit. Silkworth says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. That's true for everybody. My sister likes it. That's why she drinks. She likes the effect. She just likes a little bit of it. But I think it's more than that for me. I think I don't just like the effect. I think somewhere I thirst for the effect. I need the effect. And why would I do that? Well, Silkworth goes on to talk about that further down. But he first says a couple things that are very important. He says this sensation, this deal that I get from it, is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. There's a word that started seeping into Alcoholics Anonymous from therapeutic treatment centers and places like that back in the late 70s. The word is denial. Alcoholics Anonymous does not use the word denial. See, I can't differentiate the true from the false. I can't. When the thirst of my being is on me, I can't see that I can't even quench it with alcohol no more. The days of taking five or six drinks and playing with a band and singing and the days of shooting pool and dancing and having fun and laughing with the guys. I can't see when the thirst is on me that what I do now is I drink and I feel sorry for myself. I drink and I go on crying jags. I drink and after a day or so I stop bathing because there's no fun in the party and I don't care about nothing. I drink for oblivion. It's not fun anymore. It's pathetic. It's pathetic. But isn't it funny that I have absolute inability to see that truth when the thirst is on me? I can't see it. Alcoholism uses your own mind against you. That's why no matter how much determined I was not to drink, I always go back to it eventually. If you're an alcoholic of my type, a chronic alcoholic, and something, there isn't some sort of major transformation within you to quench that thirst. The question is not if you're going to drink again. The question is simply when. It's an absolute inevitability. And Silkworth goes to talk about the dynamic that makes that so. And if you can connect the dots within you with this, then you'll start to know a little bit about what you're up against. And he's talking about us when we're sober, and he says, I am restless. This is when I quit drinking. I become restless, irritable and discontented unless I can again experience that sense of ease and comfort I had once, but not anymore, once found in taking a few drinks. Drinks which I will see others taking with impunity without punishment. So what happens to me is that when I stop drinking, there's a period, you know, not in detox that you're fighting the withdrawal, but there's a, after the withdrawal starts, there comes a period I start feeling a little better physically, and then I get my hopes up of all the things I'm going to do now. I've turned over a new leaf. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. I'm going to do this. It's going to be great. And I'm like a balloon that you blow up and then let go. It goes like hell for a while, but it runs out of gas eventually. It always runs out of gas eventually. And I'm like that. And what happens to me is this: these feelings of this that come from this disassociated, sick, depressed, disconnected spirit start to overcome me. The feelings of restlessness, and if you're an alcoholic, you know that feeling. It's a sense that wherever you are, it's not where you need to be. Now, I don't know where I need to be. It's just not here. You know what I mean? You know that feeling? It's just that, yeah, I can't get settled anywhere. I'm irritable. I don't know that I'm irritable. And I don't believe I'm irritable because I don't like irritable people. And I'm not really irritable. But when I quit drinking, I can't help it if I just see how stupid everybody is. And because I'm restless, I need to explain it to them, which makes abstinence a lonely business. People rub me the wrong way, and I become really judgmental. I'm the guy who takes everybody's inventory. I'm the guy who can't stop looking at life and people to see what's wrong with them. I can't stop it. And it's a lonely, alcoholism is a lonely business. I'm a prisoner in a cage, and the problem is the key's on the inside. And I'm begging for people, therapists and priests and girlfriends, to set me free. The problem is they can't because the key is on the inside. And I'm discontent, and I don't know what's wrong with me, but I'm kind of an obsessive nature, I guess. I think Alcoholics Anonymous, unbeknownst to me, a therapist told me this, that it has somehow changed me for the most part from a type A to a type B personality. But I was a type A. I was the wound up guy. When I first got sober, I smoked 3 packs of cigarettes. I used to light a cigarette with a cigarette, right? I couldn't sit still for more than 10 minutes, really. I was nuts. Because I'm that way and obsessive, I'm always got my crosshairs out looking for stuff that's going to make me better. I mean, I'm always looking for stuff. And I find stuff all the time. Oh, that motorcycle. Man, if I had a Harley like that. What happens? I get it. Why is it that the shine of it wears off very quickly? I get that relationship with that person that I know that's just going to, man, that's the person I've always wanted to be with. I'm not with that person very long, and the shine of it wears off, and I just start noticing what's wrong with her, you know. And I get that job, that big money, buy a house, own a boat and a motorcycle kind of job. I don't have that job very long, and the shine of it wears off, and they're taking advantage of me, and I'm the only one here that's doing it right. And chronic malcontent. I got this hole inside of me, in the center of my being, and an obsessive nature that's constantly trying to fill it up with stuff, and no matter what I grab onto, the end result is that disillusionment again. as the bottom falls out and I'm back to being me again. One of my great, great mentors, a guy probably helped me more than anybody, was a guy named Chuck Chamberlain. Chuck used to say, if you're an alcoholic, you will eventually get to a point where you can no longer put anything between you and you. And there you are. And the shine of everything you've been trying to gratify and fill yourself up with is worn off. And it's all just, and then you're back to being you again. And if you're like me, when all's said and done, that ain't no good. That's my big secret. It's always been my big secret. It ain't no good. And so this restless, irritable, and discontent starts to work on me. And I enter into a state of abstinence, and I know by now after a couple treatment centers, I can't take the first drink. I can't smoke nothing. I can't do nothing like that. And so I get into a just say no, I really mean it this time mindset. And if you're an alcoholic of my type, you can say no. I say no a lot. No. No, no, I'm not smoking anything. No, don't. No, no pills. No, no social heroin. No, no, nothing. No, I'm telling you, no. Listen, don't. I'm a grateful alcoholic here, for God's sakes. Don't offer me nothing. No, no. I said no. Well, okay, a little bit. And if you're an alcoholic of my type, there's a yes in every barrel of no's. It may be at the bottom of the barrel. It may be at the top of the barrel. Sometimes I got high the day I got out of detox. Other times it was 10 or 11 months down the road. But there's a no, there's a yes in every barrel of no's, unless something in here changes. And Silkworth goes on to talk about that. He says, after they succumb to the desire again, as so many do, because it wears on me, no matter how tremendous my resolve is, untreated alcoholism just wears on me day in and day out. And this is, and yet I try to be positive. How you doing, Bob? Oh, work better, feel better, having a better, you know, I try to think, oh, I'm just so grateful to be sober. Right? You know, right? I try to be positive. But in here where I really live, this ain't no good. And if you're an alcoholic of my type, by the time you get to AA, I mean, you've had some people telling you about you. You've had some people telling you about you. Maybe it's been your mother and father. Maybe it's been your lover. Maybe it's been your boss. Maybe it's been your clergy. Maybe it's been your therapist. Maybe it's been your counselor. Maybe it's been your siblings. Maybe it's been your neighbors. Maybe it's been your drug dealer's been telling you there's something wrong with you. Maybe your bartender. Maybe your really bad strangers on the street start telling you about you. And they're all telling you the same thing, aren't they? Aren't they really saying, Bob, 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 Bob. Bob, you're really screwed up, Bob. If you catch me on a bad day, I'll go, yeah, I know. They go, do you know why you're screwed up? No, I don't. Well, Bob, you're screwed up because you keep getting screwed up. If you didn't get so screwed up, you wouldn't be so screwed up. So I'm pretty screwed up. I think, okay, I'm not going to get screwed up. And when I don't get screwed up, I am really screwed up. I am so screwed up. When I don't get screwed up, I'm going to eventually go get screwed up. And then some guy's saying, you know, you're really screwed up. And I go, yeah, I know. And I don't understand what's happening to me. But my alcoholism really starts where the bag in the bottle ends. There's no way in all of Alcoholics Anonymous or in this universe to treat the phenomenon of craving once it's been unleashed. If you're an alcoholic of my type and you pick up a drink, it's like having sex with a gorilla. You ain't done till the gorilla's done. There's no way to change that. But Alcoholics Anonymous has a process that does something that none of us believe can happen. It changes me from the inside out into the kind of guy that's thirst is quenched, and I'm okay. Break?
Yeah, we're going to take an 18-minute and 4-second break. We're going to start on 25 after on that clock. We will be on time.